now our feature presentation.
This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. It's October, that time of the year when there are lots of things that go bump in the night. And in Hulu's newest original film, one of those things is hair. And we're not talking about a press and curl. Bad Hair is a horror comedy that follows a black woman who changes her hair to get ahead in the late 1980s television industry. We'll be getting into the film and what it says about the horror genre in this meeting of the 1A Movie Club. And as always, we'll be discussing the film in full, spoilers and all. Joining us is 1A Movie Club Vice President John Horn. He's the host of KPCC's The Frame and of the podcast Hollywood the Sequel. John, it's great to have you back.
Great to be with you.
Also with us, Beandria July. She's a film critic. She's also co-host and producer of Cherry Pop, a new podcast that examines female pleasure in cinema. Beandria, it's great to have you back for Movie Club.
Thanks for having me, Jen.
And Ronald Young Jr. He's a film critic and host of the Time Well Spent podcast. Ron, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, John, real quickly, for people who haven't seen or heard about the film, just run the plot down for us.
Wow, this is about a young woman who wants to be seen. She's essentially invisible, and she is invisible until she essentially makes a deal with the devil to have her hair look, I think the fair way to describe it is less black. I mean, it's about straightening. It's about whether or not you can look authentic and still fit in. And it's about a deal with the devil that she makes in order to advance her career. And to me, it's more largely about the compromises that black women have to make to be taken seriously, and women of any color. So it's a story, it's a horror story, but it's really an allegory, I think, about what it takes to sacrifice part of yourself to recognize and achieve what it is you want to do professionally.
Now, Beandria, the title Bad Hair isn't just because the weave is evil. Break down that term bad hair and good hair and what it means in the black community.
Yeah, well, that would take a really long time to do, but the short of it is that, you know, black women have a history of getting our hair straightened so that it more mimics European style hair, so that it is smooth and straight. I know every black girl I know has a hot comb trauma story. Oof. From childhood. See, there you go. That's all you need to hear. But so it's just indicative of a long history of black women being told we need to achieve European beauty standards. And so good hair is, you know, hair that isn't natural, and quote unquote bad hair is the way your hair grows out of your head.
Well, we heard from one person who enjoyed the film. Here's what she left in our inbox.
This is Laquan Banks. I'm calling from Lilburn, Georgia, outside of Atlanta. I would like to say that I thoroughly enjoyed the movie. I love the imagery, and I love the story and how it showed that African-American women were pressured to change the texture of their hair. But I also enjoyed how they intertwined the story of the mauve-haired woman and how it all tied together at the end. I plan on watching the movie a couple more times, and I plan on telling everyone about it.
Thanks for that message. Okay, quick run down the panel. I want to hear how many stars you would give a Bad Hair. Beandria, I'll start with you.
I give it 4 stars. I really thought it was a fun ride. It was a roller coaster ride, you know, that had its ups and downs. But for the most part, I really enjoyed it.
Ronald, what about you?
I would give it 2 stars. And I agree with everything Beandria said. I think it was a fun ride and there were enjoyable moments. But in terms of what I think it intended to do, I think it failed at that.
John?
I'm going to split the difference. I'm going to give it 3 stars. I agree with Beandria. I think it's an interesting movie. I think there's maybe a little too much going on. I think Justin was perhaps overly ambitious, which he often is. But I think there's a real good story there. And I really respect Justin as an artist. I love Dear White People, and I kind of know him, so my opinion of the film is colored by how much I really think he's an impressive young filmmaker.
Well, Beandria, I watched the movie with a friend last night. We Zoomed it together, and I was cataloging my hair journey while I was watching it, and there were parts of it that resonated very deeply for me. The film starts with her experiencing a chemical burn from a relaxer as a young girl. And I was like, yep, remember that. You mentioned the hot comb. Did you find yourself sort of cataloging your hair experience as you were watching the film?
Well, absolutely. I mean, my grandmother is a hairdresser who had a shop in her basement all of my life. So I've been around, and my mother was the kind of woman who sent her daughters to the hairdresser every 2 weeks. So I have so many hair stories, and I really identified with it. And what I loved about the movie was that it didn't explain any of it. You know, it's like, if you don't know what it means to say don't get it wet, if you don't know about pink oil or tender-headed or why she's patting her hair like that, you know, you just don't know, and you have to just go along. And I think for me, that's one of the things I haven't seen critics talking about, was like how the movie really does not explain itself to people. And it's really made for Black women in that respect, is the strongest part of it for me.
That's hilarious, because as I was watching the film, there's a portion where she's supposed to use this potion on her hair. And that is exactly what I said. I said, oh, that's pink oil. Like, they
that's
definitely went
oil,
up in Sally's,
right?
Grabbed some pink oil and put that in.
Yes, that's right. Dudley. Shout out to Dudley's. Yes.
Well, the director, Justin Simien, is probably most well known for directing the movie and Netflix series Dear White People. And it follows a group of Black students at a predominantly white Ivy League college. You know, John, stylistically, do you see similarities between Bad Hair and Dear White People in both the themes and the artistic style?
Yeah, I mean, he is a satirist, and he works through comedy, sometimes dark comedy, but I think he has really sharp insights. And I think one of the things that he is really good about, listen, I have no understanding or experience about what Black women suffer to make their hair look unnatural. But I understand what this story is about. And I think where Justin is really strong is he takes audiences into a perspective that you might not recognize or appreciate. And I think that's why Dear White People, especially as a series, I think the movie was good, but I thought the Netflix series was better. I think he takes you into a story through some strange devices. I mean, in this movie, it's horror. In his series, it's comedy. But I think he really kind of illuminates a perspective that you wouldn't normally access if it was straight drama. And I think that's what his gift is. And I think that's why he thinks horror, much like Jordan Peele, can be highly political if you use it right.
Ron, what about you? I mean, I'm sure you have been hair adjacent to some of these conversations with Black women. What was your take?
So I grew up with a mother and a sister, and I always think about their hair journeys when I think about how passionate I am about natural hair and about a Black woman being allowed to do whatever they want with their hair. I always think about specific stories of my mother and sister that hurt me from growing up. And I can't say that I feel the pain firsthand, but I watched what they went through with their hair, watched them cry tears about, and even as a kid, like as a 7 to 12-year-old kid, I'm just like, I don't understand why they're crying, but I don't want them to be upset. And I think that's what my biggest problem with the movie is. They talk about patting the hair, they use the pink lotion, which resonated with me. I was like, oh my God, that's what pink lotion is. Like, it resonated with me. But this is where I feel the movie falls short. They did not make the connection between why Black women have to go through these things. Mm-hmm. They kind of alluded to it, and they talked about hair politics and them policing each other, saying, girl, you got to get that right hair and all that. But they didn't connect it back to white supremacy and whiteness and the reason why Black people have to do this. They made it very mystical and about the moss-haired woman. And I'm like, well, the moss-haired woman would be a white woman, right? Like, these witches are white, right? Like, you know, right. I felt like they never made that connection back. And instead, they made this beautiful movie that taught, and the imagery was beautiful. They had these great images, even about putting in a sew-in and what a bad sew-in looks like and all that, and the bloody hair and all that. They do all these beautiful things, but then they don't connect it back to the root for me. I'm like, go back to the beginning and say, why do you have to have good hair versus bad hair? And I feel like that's where it fell short.
I feel like there was an attempt to do that, but it ended up being sort of a bit of a tortured attempt to do it. It ended up being, to my mind at least, more about capitalism in this weird sort of way than it was about, I guess, there was an opportunity there to do something that was really powerful and mystical, but instead it became this sort of convoluted commentary on capitalism to my mind. But that's me. Heather emailed, I watched the movie this weekend, a bit uneven in consistency of pace. Lots of fun, though. Reminded me of Chris Rock's commentary on Good Hair. The tumbling tumbleweed. Vanessa Williams was fab. She Rise on Twitter says, it reminded me of Death by Temptation from the 1990s. Loved the African Tales. 6 out of 10 stars. John, you spoke to Justin Simien at Sundance this year, and you asked him about his approach to the subject of Black women and their hair. Let's take a listen.
You know, it's funny. Someone asked me at one of the first Q&As, like, am I supposed to feel good or bad about the weave? And the truth is that the uncomfortable answer is both. You know, there are Black women who get weaves because it's helping to protect their natural hair. There are Black women who get weaves because that's just the aesthetic that they are going for. And I didn't want so much to moralize the choice of doing this or that to your hair, but just sort of point out that, like, it's one of the many aspects of our bodies that we are having to consider or lop off just in order to be seen as equal, not even better, but just be seen at all.
Do you think he pulled off what he was aiming for, Beandrea, there? You know, trying to present the struggle Black women have to go through during their hair journey, but without really making commentary on whether weave is good or bad.
Yeah, you know, I do think the least successful part of the movie was definitely the Moss Girl element to it, specifically the end of the movie where it's revealed that a character we've seen before who is white is leading the charge for this hair kind of ring. It's very convoluted, as you said, as many of you said, and it's a little bit confusing. And I had wished the movie had ended just with, you know, that last scene where the main character is talking to her sister, mm-hmm. Because that, to me, you know, leaves it up to the viewer to decide, you know, what they think. But that ending that is there kind of sort of goes halfway there and then doesn't go all the way. So I do agree that it doesn't really, it definitely doesn't tell us what to think about it. But I do think that maybe Justin underestimated the extent to which this would push Black women's buttons, because, you know, it's sort of, we're sort of like, okay, our hair, people are always talking about our hair. There's laws against our hair. There are girls getting suspended because of their hair. And, you know, not to mention the unfair Eurocentric beauty standards. So it's like, can we just live, you know? And I do think it's kind of funny that both of the movies that people can name about Black women's hair were both made by Black men. Mm. I do think this movie is much more nuanced than Good Hair, Chris Rock's documentary, which I didn't like at all. But I do think that there's good intention here. You know, Justin, all the main characters in the movie are named after, his mother is named after Anna. Anna's named after his mother, and his aunts are the Virgie and Edna and another woman in the movie. So I think he definitely had Black women in mind, but I don't know what it is with Black gay men in wigs. Something happens.
Wait,
you know,
what?
I'm not sure. I don't know. Have you seen that? I don't know if you've seen this episode of Queer Eye where Karamo puts on a wig when they're helping one of their clients this season, and he just goes absolutely insane. Like, he turns into a different person.
I have not seen that. I mean, what I will say about this film is that it was funny. Like, there were moments when I was definitely laughing out loud. Ron, yeah. What did you think about the balance between horror, which was very campy, it was very over the top, but also comedy? Do you think Simien did a good job of balancing the two?
I think he nailed the comedy a lot. I think I'm a scaredy cat, so I don't watch scary movies. I don't watch horror movies. I've seen Get Out, I've seen Us, and I've seen this. And I think you could sense a theme in the types of horror movies that I will watch, the things that I feel like I do have to show up for, as opposed to this. But this was, there were definitely some laugh out loud moments in this, and I thought he struck that balance very well. I wasn't ever really scared, and there were, I think the only part that I really got creeped out was during the body horror parts, and that means like when the sew-in was actually happening, I cringed a lot.
Yeah.
In the beginning when she was first getting the conch in her hair, I like cringed a lot. I mean, so yeah. And I think those portions really got to me in terms of the horror elements. But the parts that were funny were I mean, very funny. Jay Farrell's character just being like a perpetual like garbage man was just, it's just very, very, very funny to me. But if I could just speak to one thing Beandrea said, which I 100% agree with, is I think the perspective matters, because I think this would have been a different movie if it were made by women instead of black women, instead of it made by black men, because there's only so much empathy and perspective I can have talking about my mother and sister versus my mother and sister telling you a story from their perspective.
Yeah, I agree with you that I had visceral reactions to both the relaxer scene when the lead character, Anna, played by Elle Lorraine, when she gets that chemical burn, and also the sew-in, because those are based in real experiences. And there was something just deeply horrifying about both of those scenes, and very realistic. I'm curious, though, John and Ron, as the guys on our panel, did you learn anything from the movie? Did you take anything away from it? John?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and I'm going to come back to this idea of like invisibility, because I think that's really what this movie is about. And if you think about the first time we meet kind of the lead character, played by Elle Lorraine, Anna, she's walking through a crowded lobby. She's invisible. Mm-hmm. No one sees her because of the way her hair looks. And then you think back to, you know, even in the autobiography of Malcolm X, he writes about conking his hair. And so for me, the bigger takeaway is like, what part of yourself, if you're a black woman, do you have to give up to fit in the way you're expected to look? And that for me was the takeaway. Listen, I'm a straight white guy. I can never understand that experience, but I'm going to learn piece by piece to try to have empathy and understand it better. And I think that's what this movie succeeds, that this woman is invisible because of the way her hair looks, and that is criminal.
Ron, I want to get your take after the break. We're discussing the new Hulu original movie, Bad Hair, with our 1A Movie Club, KPCC's John Horn, and film critics Beandrea July and Ronald Young Jr. Malin emailed, love the movie, beautifully captured the sacrifice black women experience based on our physical appearance. 4 stars, like the pace of the movie, build up to the climax. My mother-in-law was a hairdresser, loved the end language, tender-headed, don't get hair wet, etc. And Janelle says, I've been mulling over whether or not to watch this movie, and you guys have convinced me that it's worth a shot. Thank you. You are quite welcome. I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from you and from our guests in a moment. Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or maybe perfect strangers? You can get all the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle on the 1A News Roundup. Find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
On the next episode of Louder Than a Riot, the 20-year fight to clear the name of former No Limit rapper, Mac Phipps.
Because me and my brother was close. The years that he lost, that's some of the best years of his life he done lost. For me, it just hurts.
Listen now to Louder Than a Riot, the new podcast from NPR Music.
Now let's get back to our movie club discussion of Bad Hair with film critic and podcasters Beandrea July and Ronald Young Jr. and KPCC's John Horn. And just to give a sort of sum up Bad Hair for folks who may just be joining us, it's about a young woman, Anna Bledsoe, played by Elle Lorraine, who's trying to break her way into the music television industry. Think MTV or VH1, and this is in the late 1980s. She's a black woman. She has a natural style. Her hair is styled naturally. And as she enters this phase of her career, she's strongly encouraged to get a sew-in weave to help herself fit in more. And that weave ends up being possessed, haunted, evil, maybe all of the above. So we heard from Danica Robbins, who tweets, I enjoyed it. Love the tongue-in-cheek vibe and the message. No Oscar contender, but a fun movie to watch. I want to talk about a few things I really did enjoy about the film. One, Vanessa Williams, who does the whole, you know, evil, like nice, nasty thing so well. Love Vanessa Williams in it. I also really appreciated the specificity of the costuming, the hair design, just the overall late 80s and 90s feel that they were able to pull off in the film. It felt really authentic. And as a woman of a certain age, I was like, oh, this is very, 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 very familiar. Beandrea, what did you think?
I agree. I think part of the thing that I really enjoyed about this was the commitment to the era. You know, There are all these great cameos. You know, we've got Kelly Rowland playing a sort of Janet Jackson kind of figure, you know, doing the choreography that we all remember from the early 90s. And I also think that it's just all the Easter eggs, too. Like, there's quotes from En Vogue lyrics, you know, MC Light pops up. I mean, it's just, you know, I thought that was really incredible. I mean, the cast is by far the strongest thing about this movie. You know, Vanessa Williams playing the shady bitch is like her, that's her lane, you know, like, and just across the board, including, you know, the star, I just thought the cast was superb.
Yeah, the cameos were a lot of fun. Ron, what about you? Did you appreciate the late 80s, early 90s vibe?
I absolutely did. I was born in 84, so I'm a child of the, I'm a 90s kid, but I'm a child of the 80s. So a lot of that stuff felt very nostalgic and familiar. I remember at one point when she goes to the second hair salon at some point to get to sew it fixed. And I walk in and I said, that's MC Light. That's MC Light. I just kept saying it over and over again. I was just so excited to see her on the screen and to be this wise person in this, like somebody that's there to fix it. I just felt so good about saying that. So there was a lot of things about this movie that made me feel really good. I would never complain about his setting, his costume design, his scoring. I loved all of those things. Just for me, I wish the other elements would have lived up to those like great parts of the movie.
Yeah, and there are so many people in this film, Lena Waithe, Vanessa Williams, as we said, Kelly Rowland, Usher pops up, Jay Farrell, James Vanderbeek. I mean, it's just every 5 minutes there was somebody new. John, what do we know about how he was able to pull this cast together? Because it seemed like everybody was having a lot of fun.
A lot of friends of friends. I mean, and I think Justin is well liked, and he certainly called it some favors. He didn't have a lot of money to make this film. I'm going to add the music. The music, and Justin wrote a lot of the songs, and the score is by, I think, the best young composer outside of Nicholas Britell working in Hollywood, Chris Bowers. He did Green Book. He's doing some incredible work. So the music and the score are really good. But listen, Justin Simien is very honest about what happened in his career. He had Dear White People at Sundance in 2014. It took him 6 years to make another movie. And he watched a lot of his peers at Sundance go on to have careers. And Justin has said, I'm aware of the checks I never got. I'm aware of the meetings I never got. I'm aware of the pitches that never went to a green light. Like the woman in this film, he's a black artist trying to fit in, and he didn't succeed. So he really had to make this movie kind of outside the Hollywood system. It was independently financed. It didn't get sold immediately out of Sundance because it wasn't in some buyer's minds the next Get Out. So he kind of really threw this together on his own, and he, you know, found some visual effects team that was able to do the hair, the attacking hair creature, I guess. So he, you know, he was scrappy, and that's how he got the cast. That's he ended up writing the music himself. I think he's very resourceful. But again, it's a reflection of how unwelcome a filmmaker like Justin Simien still is in modern day Hollywood.
Ron, you know, when we take a step back from the film and look at it in its totality, who is the villain in Bad Hair? I mean, again, this is full spoiler here. But in the end, again, as we said, it's revealed that the head of the TV network, a white man, is running this sort of plantation where all of the killer weave is produced. But did you walk away feeling like he was the bad guy?
No, I did not. I walked away feeling like that it just stopped at the hair. And I know that at the end, because if you think about the way the movie runs out, and I think Beandria said it best, the conversation with the sister should have been the last part of that movie. Mm-hmm. That should have been what tied up everything. And it should have went back to relationships, loving yourself as you are, not having to be anybody else. But then to tie it back up to this evil white corporation, I just felt like what they did was they tried to tack that on at the end. Somebody was like, yeah, put this on. We got James Vanderbeek another 10 minutes. Put him on here. You know what I mean? And so they filmed that and put that on there. And I didn't leave thinking that James Vanderbeek was the bad person. And to me, I think this is an example of how little white women were in this movie, because I feel like white women should have been featured heavily as having the ideal Eurocentric look and their hair being a certain way. That should have played into this some, and that didn't. So for me, it just felt like, oh, the hair is the bad guy.
Yeah, you would see this one VJ as she's walking, you know, walking through the lobby of the building. And you would see this woman with very long blonde hair. And, you know, she would toss it over her shoulder. And once Anna gets this killer weave, you know, there's this moment of connection between the two of them where the blonde, you know, winks at her. But that's really the only time we see that come together. Beandria, what about for you? Who's the villain?
Yeah, you know, I think it's a combination of what both John and Ron said, is that I think it's both a Tyler Perry problem, and what I mean by that is that, you know, there just aren't enough films like this, you know, in a lot of ways. This is a very new kind of film. Black people won't admit it, but we're not used to seeing ourselves in our full complexity and having our inside conversations be told to the outside world. And I think that's part of why people are upset about it, but they may not be consciously aware of it. And then I think the other thing is, I saw it as internalized depression. Like, you know, it was conscious that Vanessa Williams was a light-skinned woman, right, mm-hmm. who was propagating these Eurocentric beauty standards. And I personally am so glad I didn't want any white women to take screen time from all the people who were there, because it was like, it wasn't about them. It was about how we've internalized those messages. Not saying that we're to blame for it, but, you know, there is internalized depression is rampant, is, you know, rampant. So I think it's a combination of both, you know, just the context into which the Hollywood context into which this movie is being released, but also just the way that Black people still suffer from the damage of all this internalized depression.
Well, John, is this a movie that would have been otherwise released in theaters if it weren't for the pandemic?
No, definitely. I mean, it's, you know, and I think it would have found an audience. I mean, I think that's one of the strange things about the times we're living in, that, you know, no movies are getting released theatrically. And now so many things are getting released on streaming services that it's actually become highly competitive, that Disney is putting a lot of its movies on Disney Plus. Universal is putting a lot of its movies on premium video on demand channels. I mean, you know, AMC, the nation's biggest movie theater chain, might go out of business in the next couple of months. They've run out of cash. So, yeah, I mean, this is a movie. And not only would it be a movie that should be in theaters, watching this movie with an audience would be a lot of fun, because there'd be a lot of talk back to the screen. And I think, and there was when I saw it in Park City at the Sundance Festival. But, you know, that is something that is going to be missed. It's the kind of film I think that would play well with a group. And I'm going to come back to like my takeaway, because I'm going to quote Lena Waithe, who is in it. She says it's a story about the adversity Black women face in the workplace. And I think you can take Black out. I think it's a story about adversity that women, it could be, you know, a female lawyer trying to fit into a firm headed by, you know, white partners. I think it's really about people who have been marginalized just based on nothing more than the way they look. And it gets this bigger issue that really kind of concerns me. And that is, like, if Noah Baumbach or Steven Spielberg make a movie, it's about the human experience. But if Spike Lee or Barry Jenkins or Justin Simien make a movie, it's about the Black experience. And that's patently unfair, because this is a movie about the human experience. These characters happen to be Black, but it's about how people are marginalized. And I think that's the takeaway that I had for the film. And I wish it wasn't kind of put in that category like Spike Lee and Barry Jenkins movies are, about a certain group of people. It's about all of us and how we judge people and how we accept people based on nothing more than how they look.
Well, on that note, let's take a quick break. We have plenty more to talk about with KPCC's John Horn and film critics Beandria July and Ronald Young Jr. And we'll do just that right after this. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from The Land I Trust, a podcast from the Sierra Club featuring people sharing their experiences with climate and justice issues. This season brings unique stories of energy transition and community transformation amidst the growing movement for environmental, racial, and climate justice. Listen to season 4 of The Land I Trust on sc.org/stories, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Voting is crucial, and I don't give a damn how you look at it.
Is this a man?
It was we, the people.
The land of the free and the home of the brave.
Not we, the white male citizens.
Misrepresentative Democracy.
A new series about voting in America from NPR's Throughline.
Listen now.
This is 1A, and we're continuing our conversation about Hulu's original movie, Bad Hair. And we got this email from John that sort of speaks to what we were talking about before the break. He says, I counter that a white man can understand black hair. It is forgotten that many white men suffer male pattern baldness, and starting in the 20s, get the invisible treatment that we hide behind hats, hair dye, toupee, and head shaving to not feel invisible in a room of attractive people. You know, Beandria, I hear that, but I'm thinking back to the way black women's hair, my own included, has been politicized from the time, you know, we are tiny little girls. And even now, when I went natural in my 30s, if on the rare occasion I would get a blowout and my hair would be straight, the comment would be, oh, you look so professional, which is infuriating that my natural curly hair is considered unprofessional in some way. So I'm curious how you've experienced this and how you think about it as a black woman.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the reason I can have the view I have about the movie is that I have never really been interested in weaves. I tried it once and I said, this is not for me. And I have kept my hair natural for the majority of my adult life. I'm just in general low maintenance person. So short hair works for me because it's less time. But I do think that, you know, our hair stories are very personal. You know, I used to think of hairdressers as healers because, like I said, my grandmother was a hairdresser. And also, I always knew as a child that, like, if my mom was in a bad mood, I used to wish she had a hair appointment because she would come back a completely different person.
It's part therapy. It's part hairstyling. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So it is, it sort of is an interesting twist for me on, like, ooh, what if hairdressers were evil? You know, like, you know, and just, again, universalizing the black female experience. But the only way you can get that is if you know the cues of the black women's experience.
Well, we've got to have sort of mixed opinions about this film, but there's this larger conversation about black filmmakers and criticism, and they get into it a bit on a show on another streaming platform that started a similar conversation. Here's a clip from Netflix's Black AF, and in it, creator and star Kenya Barris talks about a movie he dislikes with other black filmmakers.
Did you guys see that link I sent you with the movie? What'd you think?
Who did it? Oh, so it was pretty good. Pretty good.
Yeah, I agree. It was cool. It was cool.
I'm gonna stop you right there. That was not cool. There was nothing cool about that movie. You guys know it, dude. Come on. You know what I'm saying? Like, how are we ever gonna get better if this is how we are with each other? We have to be able to talk honestly if we want our art to progress. We do it all the time with white stuff. Why can't we do it with our own stuff? You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't know. Like, if I asked you what you thought about Green Book.
Please don't bring up that movie.
So I want to hear your take on, you know, the relationship between black directors, black filmmakers, and black criticism. Beandria?
Yeah, I mean, it was funny reading through all the critics, the reviews from the movie versus the ones who saw it at Sundance, which is largely like majority white, you know, legacy publication critics and folks who just saw it. And it was really clear that they did not understand the pink oil aspects of it. You know, like, that's the part that gives its pop. You know, they didn't understand the 90s references. And so for them, they were just purely looking at it as, you know, structurally as a film and didn't have the visual, like, the eyes to see what was in front of them. And so I do think that's a big part of it. I do think also when I first saw it at Sundance as well, a lot of my black women critic friends were not happy with it. And I was sort of going in expecting to hate it. And I left being like, I wonder why they were mad. I mean, I guess it's just because I don't have I don't think about weave like that. And I don't have a lot of lived experience with it. So, well,
Rhonda, we've got just about 30 seconds here. Your take?
Yeah, I feel like generally, like, black movies and black movies about the black experience, they deserve to receive criticism just like white movies about the life experience. And I think the problem is because there's not enough black movies that are made and we don't get the full spectrum of black movies, people get upset when you make fun of the few that we have or you criticize the few that we have. So I think that's the bigger problem. Make more black films and then we can criticize all of them.
That's Ronald Young Jr. He's a film critic and host of the Time Well Spent podcast. Also with us today, Beandria July. She's a freelance film critic. She co-hosts and produces Cherry Pop. It's a new podcast that examines female pleasure in cinema. And as always, John Horn. He's the host of KPCC's The Frame and the vice president of the 1A Movie Club. I think we should make that an official title. Thanks to you all for joining us for the Movie Club. Let's do it again next month. Just to wrap up, Denise tweeted, I watched this weekend and give it 6 out of 10. Well worth the watch. The one-liners were hilarious. This conversation was produced by Emmanuel Johnson and edited by Matthew Simonson. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks so much for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.